This is my father's track 9 of his course on madness, which was typed in 1982. The beginning of this track was muffled and unintelligible. I cut most of it out.
This track begins poorly, but eventually is understandable. This is an important track. He outlines his basis for his theory of madness.
If you do, if you use the logic of madness, why does genius sometimes go mad? Is it because genius has madness in its blood?
Not likely. Neither blood nor circumstance has this power.
You have to feel to something else that looks more carefully at the nature of particular forms of genius and particular forms of madness. For just as there are different kinds of genius, witness the incredible difference in the achievements of Nietzsche and Nijinsky,
there are also different kinds of madness. Nijinsky went mad his way, Nietzsche his. Van Gogh went the way of Nijinsky. Herderlin, the way of Nietzsche. Why? Because their temperaments so dictated. Madness takes on a form entirely consistent with sanity. There are ways of being insane that are derivatives of corresponding ways of being sane. Who lives sanely in a certain style must be mad in that style and no other. Nature allows no other course. All of us live sanely in our natural and inborn style. If we now choose madness, we do not have the freedom to opt for a different kind of madness than that given by our make. Madness is our Procrustean bed. We made it, now we must lie in it and suffer the excision of any of our members, whether act or organ, that is unfitting to our nature. We cannot be crazy in any other way than the way we are sane, since insanity, like sanity, requires ability. We can be mad brilliantly or stupidly, or we may be mediocre in it. Madness respects our intellect even more than does sanity. There cannot, for instance, be drama in the madness of the dull-witted. Behold the cosmic anger of a peeved moron, one once said. Behold no such thing, for cosmic anger is reserved exclusively for the mad philosopher, to Nietzsche. To be angry at the gods, as was Nietzsche, presupposes the ability to conceptualize the gods. So stupidity and madness are contingent. I can embrace only that madness my intelligence allows me. Conversely, if my cognitive powers know no boundaries, so then will my madness be boundless and my tantrums godly. Ability is a dimension of temperament, not a quantum added to it. This ability given to my temperament has ways of both limiting and enabling my madness. There are degrees of ability, just as there are also kinds of ability. I may be extremely capable in my way, but a complete numbskull in yours. You and I may be equally capable, but each in his own way, each in our own way, so that when we go out of our minds, we contrive equally gifted madnesses, even though our crazy acts bear no resemblance to each other. We might note in passing that neither of us fashions our madness out of our weak armaments. Rather, we haul out our big guns, knowing if we must go mad, we should do it with a loud bang and not a cowardly whimper. Besides there being different kinds of madness, there are degrees of it. Healers have long recognized this. Witness our quick and dirty levels, which we call maladjusted, neurotic, and psychotic. And on top of these levels are the so-called mixed types, the latter conceding that there's no line of demarcation between levels. Moreover, degrees of madness exist within kinds of madness. One kind cannot be said to be more madness than another. That makes no sense. Within a given category, however, the madness of one person can plainly outstrip the madness of another in degree. One hysteric, for instance, can far outshine another in the quantity and duration of his anesthesias. In the same sense that consciousness is always consciousness of, just as the foot cannot perceive, it also cannot not perceive the entire body being imperceptive. Freud and his disciples spoke of the conscious mind. Wait a minute. I'm through. I'm getting into another topic. Before I launch into the principles, I want to make a comment about this idea that ability, that madness requires ability. I want to speak about abilities, intelligence, of the types. I want to solve that into this conversation in advance, because I'll probably never get to it if I don't do it right now. I just read you a brief essay on the idea that the form of madness is inborn in our make. I would add that the form of our intelligence, our intellects, is also inborn, woven into our nature, our make. So, and now this is an hypothesis. It's a guess. It's speculation. It's a fiction. But I think it's since the theory is that we fashion our mad acts out of our repertoire of abilities, then it would do us well, it would serve us well to know what these abilities are. This is what I believe about the four values, the four desires, the four, as I will point out later, sources of pride. That one group of people are born good at art, they are born artisans. The Greek word for this is techne. We'll just call it tech. They're born with technique. Another way to say it is that they are born with clever eyes and clever ears and clever hands and clever feet. Smart eyes, smart ears, smart hands, smart feet. Intelligent eyes, intelligent ears, intelligent hands, and intelligent feet. Which means that when the activity at hand, so to speak, requires intelligent eyes and ears, hands and feet, then the SPs will not have to practice very much, won't have to work very hard. It will be done without effort, without training, or very little training. It will be done like shooting ducks in a rain barrel. It's, so to speak, their second nature to do this. And that this is intelligence. I'll shorten it. IQ equals is efficient behavior. No more, no less. To say it in other language, intelligence is doing well under varying circumstances. My guess is that that's the first definition of intelligence you have ever heard. If you have looked at the history of the idea of intelligence, you will have noted that the people concerned about the problem all declined to define intelligence. All of them. David Wexler tried, but he engaged in so much excursion and contradiction that the definition that he actually gave made no sense. It was incoherent. The rest of them, the people that made up intelligence tests, simply didn't bother to say what intelligence was. Some of them, joking, said that intelligence is what intelligence tests measure, which was a pun, which a lot of people still take seriously. But that's a joke. The guy's being funny. So, this is the first definition of intelligence. Terman said, a person is intelligent in the degree that he is able to engage in abstract thinking, which was a cop-out. But he was sort of saying, well, abstract thinking, whatever the hell that is what intelligence is. But if you look at the content of his testing device, you'll note that a lot of the tasks in the Stanford-Binet, for instance, which is the one Terman did, copying Binet, requires a kind of behavior which we may, after the Greeks, call analysis, which means taking something apart. And of course, that's quite different from artisanship, which is to make the next move in a performance efficiently. If that performance is a variable, let me give you a metaphor for that. Here's the treble clef. Either that's a treble clef or that is, I'm not sure which. And the artist puts down a sign that he's supposed to hit this level on the scale. And I noticed that he had 11 places that he could have put that. Not true? 11 variables to choose from, and he picked number 9. Or number 8. Well, between 8 and 9. And now the next move is up to him, of course. He's got the pen. The question is, where does it belong? It doesn't belong anywhere. The next move is a variable. And let's say he puts it here. And there's some other variables. You know, he can do a half note or a three-quarter or 9/10 or whatever. And now he's got a lot of variation, which is art. That's art, artisanship, or technique. Or the Germans call it Kraft. Same thing, just three different languages. That's what art is being good at making the next move, the next variable move. That's art, and that is almost the opposite of analysis, which is where everything is deductive. All moves are deductive, absolutely given logically. There is no variation at all. If you vary from the exact move, you have made an error. There can't be any errors in art, because the next move is absolutely variable. Now, it may not sound so good or look so good, but you can't call it an error, because it's not called for at all. It's variable. So, now what I'm saying here is that you can be just as much a genius, as there are many of them in the history of the Western world, just as brilliant, just as intelligent, doing this kind of behavior, that is artisanship, as doing this kind of behavior. The fact that the people who made up the intelligence tests were always MTs gave all of us MTs quite an edge on the rest of you guys, because we made up the tests, and naturally most of the tasks in an intelligence test are analytic, and we can do that stuff without effort, without even worrying about it. You know, it's just nothing, second nature. It's built into the character itself, and so it doesn't take any practice or thought, and just do it. Just like this artisanship is built right into the SP soul. No, they picked these tasks out of very long lists of tasks. Selected these because they had smooth growth curves, so that when you have age as a variable, so as the people get older, a higher percent pass. And if your curve is like that, it's a smooth curve, doesn't have any jumps on it, and it. So that with increasing age, you get a higher percent passing. See, so then you get a curve like that. You don't have a big jump like that. See, that would be a rough curve, and so that'd be a lousy item. So you reject that from your test battery, and put only those that follow the curve in. That's how they got tests like block designs and whatnot, because of the smoothness of the growth. Purely statistical manipulation. It had nothing to do with trying to measure equally the different kinds of intelligence. In fact, there was no notion of there being different kinds of intelligence. Remember, Spearman's G is general intelligence. The person is intelligent generally, across the board. No matter what you have him do, he's smart. Or he's stupid generally across the board, no matter what you have him do. And that was the idea, that you were trying to measure G, general intelligence, after Spearman. And there were some fits and starts on special kinds of intelligence, but not much came of that movement. So that's how they got their items. Smooth growth curves. All of them. Binet, Wechsler, and a host of others. But the point I want to belabor is that the work of the artisan is just as much intelligence as the work of the logician or the mathematician.
the NAS are, in my view, book, the interpreters, the translators. They can
figure out what something means without effort. You don't see it. It's again built right into their nature. It's a very natural thing to do. They don't have to work at it, don't have to sweat it out, it comes effortlessly. The rest of us have to work at it, and we make a lot of mistakes, but they are tend to be very accurate in interpreting messages. That's why they make good writers of fictional information. And also, again, I'm saying that's you can be a genius or a numbskull in doing that sort of thing. And a person can be smart at doing that sort of thing, and stupid at doing that sort of thing, and stupid at doing that sort of thing, and stupid at doing that sort of thing. Or a person can be brilliant doing this and not a slouch at doing some of the other things. You know, there are all kinds of possibilities. You have four kinds of intelligence. You can have a pattern like that. You know, measuring the height of one's achievement and that kind of behavior. Or you can have a pattern like this. You have any pattern. So being smart in one way does not preclude being smart in another way, but it doesn't guarantee being smart in any other way either. What I'm going to say later on, I'm going to try to point out how the defenses, the protective measures that an individual takes, are fashioned out of these kinds of intelligence. That's why I said in the beginning, going mad takes intelligence, it takes ability. If you're a moron, you're going to have a moronic level madness. You cannot have a Nietzschean cowering madness. You've got to be smart to be mad in a smart way. Too bad.
I've forgotten the precise word that I arrived at for the SJs. I'm going to call it adjudication. The adjudicators, they know how to set things right without effort. And this has many forms. Each of these has many forms. But I want to read into the record the notion that intelligence is not of a piece. It's of four pieces. And that variation on one scale is unrelated to variation on the other scale. They vary independently, I think. Of course, that's something that has to be looked at. Yes?
I know you've already started by making a statement about these things, but it is somewhat dissatisfying to know that that's fiction. That it seems to be that we're just inborn that way, innately that way.
You don't want it to be a fiction? Either.
I guess I'd want something. I mean, at some point, I have to make an assumption.
That's right. You do. that's one thing you cannot avoid. If you're going to speculate, you must speculate. Whether you call it a fiction or speculation or fantasy, it doesn't really change it. It's nature. You can never change that kind of a sentence into something that can be seen.
No way. It will always remain something that cannot be seen. Just like if I essay to talk about thought, thinking, whatever I say about it has to be a fiction. Because I can never see thinking. So, sorry.
That's all right.
You're going to encounter the same problem for the same dissatisfaction. If you are dissatisfied with fictions, you have nothing to replace them with. You cannot replace them with observations. Now, you can make some predictions. You have this nice guess, or this nice definition of what something is, or this nice guess about how things relate to each other. And this now becomes a tool, or what somebody calls an heuristic, that is a useful device, to make some predictions which you could not otherwise make, and then go and see if the prediction turns out. If your prediction turns out the way you called it, then you will be satisfied with your fiction. If your prediction doesn't turn out, then you will be a little dissatisfied with your fiction. So you've got that isn't the end of the road to pronounce a fiction and just let it go at that. Now you're in the position to go out and observe something. Maybe that's what you want, are some predictions. If you go to a certain place at a certain time with certain people, this is what you're going to see. And then you can go and see. You know, check it out for yourself. I can't go into the predictions that this theory sets up. But believe me, there are many, many predictions that it does set up, because it's quite a departure from previous implied definitions of intelligence. I think the implied definitions of intelligence have meant mainly that intelligence is something that goes on in your head. And if what goes on in your head is, quote, good, then you're smart, you're intelligent, and if what goes on in your head is bad, then you're not so intelligent. But notice that kind of definition, although it was only implied, doesn't really get you anywhere. There's nothing, you can't open up the head. Even if you do open the head, all you see is a bunch of jelly, and that isn't going to help you at all. I wonder how this got so messed up. I want to go through several ideas in presenting this, the holistic theory, and in some detail. First, what is assumed? This is taken for granted, TFG. No intention of looking. Nothing empirical about this. I mean, I'm not going to snoop around. I'm not going to try to prove it. I'm going to try to support it. Just take it for granted. It's the way it is. Either the Greeks or the Latins, I'm not sure which, call this a postulate. Or another name for it is an axiom. An axiom is a hub or base or fulcrum or pivot or ground for something else. Think of it as an axis around which things move. So that's what I mean by, that's another way of saying it. I'm going to take it for granted. And this is what is taken for granted, that madness is a matter of character, that is, one behaves characteristically when mad, as when one is okay. Second one is that madness is always tactical. There is no such thing as doing something in a mad way that is not tactical. That's just I'd say it's not negotiable. And I say no way to ever check this out. Assume it, take it for granted. If a person were ever to say, well, that's something you never see, because it's in it. The idea is that it's the person has the intention of what he does is intentional in the sense that it's there's a reason for it. In a social situation, and so therefore implicitly, all madness, all forms of madness are social phenomena. That's an axiom then, and I'm not going to make any attempt to prove it to anybody, establish it, be empirical about it. That's just, well, that's the system. You might call it the system postulate. Okay, so what about tactics? And I would ask you, incidentally, I think I did this before, instead of talking about symptoms, which is rather meaningless to us all, that instead of saying symptoms, you speak of tactics. Because you understand that word very well, and it presupposes the postulate, that is the postulate, that there are character tactics embedded in a social situation, which will help us understand madness. There are characteristic tactics. And these never occur except in a social situation. It's quite impossible to even think of, dream of, characteristic tactics occurring in a non-social situation. That is to say, where nobody else around. Just unthinkable. Okay. So I want to go through seven ideas tonight in as much detail as possible and in outlining this theory. The first of them is the idea that shame is the source of all madness. You may recall that this can be deduced from what Alfred Adler said, because he was the first to bring self-regard in as something important to understand about madness. Then Freud's idea that all tactics are defensive. The third idea, and I don't know whether I'll go at them in this order or not, but third idea is Haley's, that that all tactics are paradoxical. The fourth idea is that all tactics are hypnotic. The fifth one is that all tactics are relationship defining, which is Haley's idea. Let's give this one to Bateson, even though he was applying it only to the so-called schizophrenes. I'm saying all tactics are paradoxical. And let's give this one to Haley. And I don't know who to give that one to. Hypnotic, who cares? Freud. And Mr. Adler here. To put it back into this perspective of history, show that this didn't come all of a sudden from Zeus's brow, the theory built up gradually. The sixth idea, I'll label it the Greek bathos, or pseudopathic, still Greek, or phony baloney. All tactics are phony baloney, yeah. Ain't no such thing as a genuine, authentic, fully meant message, tactical message. And I don't know how to name this last one. I get into all kinds of trouble with myself. I wonder if maybe I'm contradicting myself with it. I'm still fiddling with it, but I don't want to leave it out because I'm going to call it the rule of organic participation, and I'll get probably to that one last. It's something the effect that the organs of the body participate in the in this phony baloney. So that's the what I hope to go through tonight. And might as well begin with the concept of shame. Which brings us back to where I started, ability, intelligence. Let me read it so I won't, as an opening shot. A mentally ill person is a person who is ashamed. Sick persons do odd things only when and only to the degree they feel ashamed of themselves. Shame is the sole and exclusive impetus to disapproved behavior. I should say, it's a necessary condition. I shouldn't say sole and exclusive, but it is a necessary condition for the onset of disapproved behavior or tactics. The profoundly psychotic and the mildly neurotic are, respectively, profoundly ashamed and mildly ashamed. So it is not guilt or fear or anger or despair that result in strange proceedings, but shame and shame alone. Now note this well. If you have any acquaintance with extant speculation about why people do crazy things, you will have noted that those four ideas are frequently and heavily used as a kind of explanation for madness. Guilt, fear, anger, and despair. Usually, people in our field will equate the concept of fear with the concept of anxiety, which is a big mistake because they are not equitable in any way whatsoever. So I should add to that list that this theory is that it is not anxiety either. Is a necessary condition for mad tactics. So, guilt, fear, anxiety, anger, or despair, none of these then, in this theory, are held to be of much importance at all. These emotions are the result of and not the impetus for doing strange things. That is to say, they come about in the course of one's maneuvers, not at the offing of these maneuvers. They do not stand there before the maneuvers begin, but they come at some time during the maneuvers. So what I'm saying is here, shame, then madness, not fear, despair, anxiety, guilt, then madness. So, shame, then madness, then guilt, then fear, then anger, then despair, then anxiety. In that order. The one most frequently named as the where it all begins is anxiety. The second most cited as standing up front before madness is guilt. The others are usually not given such a heavy role. But notice what I'm doing with them. I'm bundling the whole caboodle, putting them back down in as part and parcel of the madness itself. Indeed, I'm going to try to show how each and every one of these are very tactical. And I might add, very efficiently tactical. If mental illness is based on shame,